Greetings. I'm Dr. LaPrincess Brewer, an advanced cardiology fellow at Mayo Clinic. During today's Mayo Clinic Talks, we'll be discussing bioprosthetic valve thrombosis. I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Soren Pislerou, consultant and associate professor of medicine who specializes in valvular heart disease. Welcome, Dr. Pislerou.
Well, thanks a lot for having me here.
We are here to discuss a very relevant and timely topic on the diagnosis and management of bioprosthetic valve thrombosis. Although a rare occurrence in clinical practice, when present, it can be life-threatening. Dr. Pislerou and colleagues recently published a nice case series of the Mayo Clinic experience with bioprosthetic valve thrombosis in a paper entitled Misconceptions, Diagnostic Challenges, and Treatment Opportunities in Bioprosthetic Valve Thrombosis. Lessons from a Case Series, published in the European Journal of Cardiothoracic Surgery during May of this year. The study provided excellent insight into the diagnostic challenges of bioprosthetic valve thrombosis and offers clear recommendations on improving echocardiographic diagnosis. We are eager to hear your expertise. Firstly, can you provide us with background on bioprosthetic valve thrombosis as a medical issue? And does it exist beyond isolated cases or patients with a known high risk for thrombosis?
So this is a quite difficult question to answer. And the reason for that is it has been quite hard to diagnose the condition in the first place. If you do not know a problem exists, you will not find it. In other words, you know what they say, the eyes will not see what the mind doesn't know. I guess the first troubling issues came with the realization that a number of patients who had bioprosthetic valves implanted come back for redo surgery early on. Hartzell Schaff, who is our lead surgeon in for many years now, has published his experience with aortic valve bioprosthetic thrombosis. He reported on experience spanning almost 12 years. They had over 4,000 aortic valve prosthetic implantations, and of those, about 3,000 were porcine. All the cases that do report, that they did report, had essentially porcine valves, and the incidence was actually quite low, just about 0.18%. So that means low. At the same time, we do not know how many patients did have valve thrombosis and were never diagnosed, or were outside the two-year window that was predefined for the search that they performed. More troubling signal came from a very systematic review from Denmark. This has been published in JAMA just a couple of years ago. And the study encompasses essentially every single aortic valve replacement that has been performed in Denmark. So they have a registry that every hospital in the country subscribes to. And they do also have data on every single medication these patients have been on. And the troublesome part that they noticed was that if you discontinued warfarin within the first 6 months after aortic valve replacement, you are actually more likely to die, you are more likely to have a stroke, and you are more likely to have a thromboembolic complication. And it is hard to not associate this finding with the possibility of aortic valve thrombosis being the common reason for all these events. So with that in mind, we thought we should look a little bit at our own experience with bioprosthetic valve thrombosis. And this is what we plan to talk about today.
All right, great. Thank you for that insight on the current medical literature in this realm. So just to move along, which valve position is at higher risk of thrombosis?
We usually think that the valves that are at lower gradients and lower flow rates are at increased risk of thrombus. And typically, tricuspid is the highest risk, followed by the mitral, followed by the aortic valve position. With the pulmonary valve, we do not have enough data points, but certainly we have seen in our series pulmonary valve prosthetic thrombosis, so that exists there too. It's probably the same risk as aortic valve. It's just the numbers are much smaller. We have much fewer patients who have a pulmonary prosthesis rather than the other three.
Okay, and what about porcine versus pericardial valves?
A common thing is in the literature is that porcine valves are probably more thrombogenic than pericardial valves. And the question is why? And there are many, many hypotheses. One of the hypotheses generated by the Schaff paper was that the porcine valves actually have a rail. That's by design. The porcine tissue has to be sewn into the valve ring, and that creates an area where perhaps there's some stasis. Now, that being said, is it that we see more commonly a porcine bioprosthetic valve being thrombosed than pericardial because they are more common, because they have been longer around, or is it because they thrombose more? We have seen also pericardial valves thrombosing, but certainly these are a lower number in our series.
Okay. And also, what about stented versus stentless designs? Any differences there?
I think stentless design is thought to be less thrombogenic, but there are so few, because this is all so modern, that we cannot really comment. We did not have a stentless valve thrombosed in our series, so we are waiting to see.
Okay, so from an epidemiologic standpoint, when is the peak incidence of bioprosthetic valve thrombosis?
One thing that I really want to emphasize is this misconception on when the bioprosthetic thrombosis occurs. Everyone knows that the first 3 months after implantation are high risk. The thought behind that is it takes so long for the valve to be re-endothelialized. And because of that, the vast majority of centers will systematically anticoagulate patients for mitral, tricuspid, and pulmonary prostheses, plus minus aortic prosthesis for the first 3 months. Beyond 3 months, people usually do not think of the valves as being thrombogenic at all, and hence they perhaps let their guard down. What we noticed in our series is that the peak incidence is actually the second year after implantation, and the longest in our published series, it's about 7 years out post-implantation. And I have to say, we keep an active surveillance on this issue, and just a few months ago, we identified a patient 10 years after implantation with confirmed bioprosthetic valve thrombosis, successfully treated with warfarin.
Okay. And how can we diagnose bioprosthetic valve thrombosis? And are there any specific echocardiographic findings we should be looking for?
This is the biggest challenge of them all. I think the most important part is to be aware that the condition exists. We looked at our series, so we identified patients with bioprosthetic valve thrombosis based either on surgical data. In other words, they had surgery for one reason or another, and that pathology, there was confirmed thrombus on the valve. Or we identified them based on clinical grounds. So the active cardiologist involved with the patient thought of possibility, treated them with vitamin K, and the gradient across the valve decreased. But when you look back at our echo data in this 31 patient series, what we noticed is really a minority of patients in whom the initial echocardiogram suggested the possibility of bioprosthetic thrombosis. All the echo reports describe abnormal valves. The common findings are thickened leaflets and increased gradient. So these are the two common findings on an echo report. So once you see these, you need to be aware that bioprosthetic thrombosis is in the differential diagnosis. So what we suggested in our paper was to consider the possibility whenever the gradient is more than 50% above the baseline value or above the published reference if you do not have the post-implant data. And you have thickened leaflets. Whenever you see that, you probably should consider a TE as a confirmation test for bioprosthetic thrombosis. That being said, even the TE is not perfect because of imaging, especially of the aortic valve bioprosthesis, is extremely challenging. You have to image across the valve ring, and that creates acoustic shadowing. So in our series, 9 out of 12 patients with thrombosed aortic valves had been diagnosed with TE, but 3 out of 12, we were not able to identify them, even if there was confirmation at pathology of the thrombus being present. So it's quite a challenge. We do not know how well CT fares, so CT is another possibility to look at these. Other modalities, I do not think will play a role in diagnosis.
Okay, and so what are the differential diagnoses for this?
The common problem is early valve degeneration for a host of reasons. We know this does occur. We do not know whether some of the valve degeneration start as valve thrombosis. This is a wide, just pure speculation, so we cannot make this claim. But you could imagine that if a valve thromboses, that thrombus gets organized, and that can lead to valve degeneration later on in a patient's history. Looking at all the echo reports, we struggle many times to explain our findings of increased gradients with other sources of high gradients, such as high flow. So if somebody has anemia, or somebody's hypothyroid, or somebody has sepsis and has high flow, sometimes the gradient is increased because of the secondary condition rather than a valve problem. But even then, you should keep in mind that you could have valve thrombosis under those circumstances too. It's not because you have anemia that you cannot have a thrombosed aortic valve prosthesis, for instance.
And moving along to therapeutics, can you tell us about the current options such as surgery versus thrombolytics versus anticoagulation?
This is a very, very important treatment decision. And if you look at the guidelines, because there's really a lack of data on bioprosthetic thrombosis, European and American guidelines both discuss mostly how to treat mechanical valve thrombosis. And there's virtually nothing on bioprosthetic valves. And people assume that because you have a valve thrombosis, you should use the treatment that is designed for mechanical valves. That treatment in the United States favors surgery and thrombolytic therapy for left-sided valves if there is occlusive thrombus, and favors vitamin K anticoagulation if you're stable, plus minus heparin, plus minus aspirin. European guidelines also talk about optimal anticoagulation if you have low thrombus burden, or if there's no evidence of heart failure, and favor more an intervention like lytics or surgery if those are present. What we've seen actually is, in our series, we had about 17 patients treated with either lytics or surgery, and about 15 patients treated with just warfarin, vitamin K antagonist. They did equally well. So 13 of 15 patients treated with warfarin had improvement in their gradients, had the resolution of their symptoms. So what we suggested is really vitamin K antagonist should be considered first line of therapy whenever the patient is stable enough to have a longer treatment. If you have hemodynamic instability, if you have a large thrombus burden or a mobile thrombus that you're afraid may embolize, then obviously you need to consider surgery or lytics.
And what about novel oral anticoagulants for bioprosthesis? Do these have any role?
This is a complete unknown. And the reason for that is novel anticoagulants are not approved for use in patients who have bioprosthetic valves. They were never studied in this population. And really, there's no data to support their use or refute their use, for that matter. There is one single study, if you try to search the literature, there's one study that proposed to evaluate whether novel anticoagulants can be used instead of warfarin in treating patients with freshly implanted bioprosthetic valves. The results have not been published yet, so we have no data. I would really discourage anybody to treat with novel anticoagulants until we have some sort of evidence that they do work or not. As you know, and everybody knows by now, the mechanical valves and novel anticoagulants, that was a disaster story.
Yes. And can you please define the incidence based on surgical registry data?
So what we have to do really is be more aware of what we have. So what we plan to do as a next step is to go to examine our entire surgical population. And we propose to look at all the patients that have increased gradients within the first 5 to 10 years after implantation, and see, is this a problem that is of greater magnitude that we appreciated before? Retrospective studies are always hard. It's always important to keep the awareness high. And actually, over the last less than 1 year, we accumulated more cases treated with vitamin K than in the first 16 years of our previous study. So the disease exists, it's present. If we know about it, we can treat it. So I think we really want to make a push to raise the awareness about this condition.
And what are the risk factors for bioprosthetic valve thrombosis?
I think the common things are common. So if you have a hypercoagulable state, probably you are at higher risk of having a thrombosed valve. If you have a very low left ventricular systolic function, probably you have a higher risk of thrombosing your valve. Atrial fibrillation, common things. Are they the only one important? We don't know. There's just not enough data to propose other factors. The other things are porcine, pericardial, stented, non-stented, small valves versus large valves. So all these factors, we do not have enough data points to make any significant judgment. We are looking actively in patients who did have confirmed thrombosis and had their valve replaced versus the ones who had their valve replaced for degenerated disease. We're looking if there's anything to differentiate them or identify risk factors, but that's going to be a long-term project.
And finally, you've alluded to its importance, but how do we raise awareness in the cardiology community on bioprosthetic valve thrombosis to guide clinical practice change?
Well, one of the key points is to send the message out, and this is a wonderful opportunity we have through our cooperation with heart.org. I hope that people tune in and see what we have to say, and we will link to our materials and presentations before. We did present the data at various meetings already, and we obviously will try to show our data in the future European and American society meetings. I think word of mouth goes a long way. We try to show this at various Mayo CME meetings, and we'll see.
Okay, well, thank you, Dr. Pizzaru, for these very important insights, which will definitely change our clinical practice. And also thanks to our listeners for tuning into Mayo Clinic Talks at theheart.org on Medscape.
Thank you for having me.